The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
From the Carver Center for Public Radio, this is 91.3 FM KUAF, your home for NPR news and NPR programs since 1985. And this is Ozarks at Large for Monday, June 19th, 2017. I'm Kyle Kellums. This week, momentum will build in Rogers for the Northwest Arkansas Championship LPGA event and in Springdale for the Rodeo of the Ozarks. Both begin officially later this week. Along with the Cowboys and golfers, there are entertainment events attached to each. Bite NWA, a culinary-based experience, is connected to the golf tournament. It begins Thursday night with cooking demonstrations from chefs from here and elsewhere. You can find out more at bitenwa.com. The rodeo weekend actually opens Wednesday with a 3 o'clock parade in downtown Springdale. You can see a rundown of the Rodeo of the Ozarks events in and out of Parsons Arena at rodeooftheozarks.org. Ahead on today's show, the Fayetteville Square hosts its share of events, from homecoming parades to farmers markets. A new book chronicles the history of the square, beginning in the first quarter of the 19th century, and it lists every business to ever hang a shingle there. We'll talk to the authors in about 16 minutes. First, a veteran sustainable agriculture training program established in Fayetteville appears to be spreading roots across the nation. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich takes us to the farm.
Margot Hale, Southeast Regional Director for the National Center for Appropriate Technology, NCAT for short, stands in the hot sun this afternoon, observing a group of U.S. military veterans engaged in armed to farm.
So all of our trainings focus on small-scale, sustainable agriculture, organic agriculture,
which is trending on town square markets as well as in retail supply chain grocery aisles.
So Arm to Farm is it focuses on the business and financial side of owning and operating a farm. So we spend time talking about business planning and record keeping. We talk about marketing, and then we visit a variety of farms.
This week, veterans have toured fruit and vegetable farms, beef, cattle, sheep, and goat operations. And today, a pasture-raised poultry and swine farm called Across the Creek. Wilbur, a huge boar, wallows in a large puddle in his spacious, forested, movable pen. After sloshing around, he suddenly stands up and shakes, flinging mud at the startled vets nearby. Wilbur is a major stud, producing litters of piglets with his harem of sows. In another movable pen stands an ancient covered wooden wagon tricked out with nesting boxes. Hens peck and scratch beneath as Across the Creek farmer, Terrell Spencer, explains the benefits of pasture-raised swine and poultry.
Can you guys guess what the hardest thing for avian influenza to get around is? Sunlight.
Terrell Spencer, a U.S. Army veteran and former NCAT specialist, helped launch Arm to Farm. Spencer says a program which brings together all sorts of veterans with a common vision is therapeutic.
We've had guys out here with severe PTSD that we've worked with that have gotten some help, or guys that there are guys alive because of this farm. When the moment came to pull the trigger, they couldn't.
Couldn't pull the trigger because veterans realize there's help to start new lives. They're able to secure agricultural livelihoods with available startup funds from USDA Farm Service Agency and Natural Resources Conservation Service, as well as low-cost loans from state agencies like Arkansas Farm Credit. Arm to Farm training is also free, Margot Hale says.
For instance, this training, we have a grant with the University of Arkansas Poultry Science Department. The USDA ARS station is a partner on that grant. And so depending on where we're at across the country operating an arm-to-farm program, we'll have different partners, but lots of great organizations, universities, and others that support this work.
And the training is taking root in other states.
We've held trainings in Mississippi, New York, Montana, Texas, and this summer we'll also hold one in Maine, and we are expanding to other states across the country as well.
Hale says Arm to Farm draws veterans from all branches and walks of life. 200 have participated so far, with 100 signed up this summer. Trainings continue to be limited to just 30, although many more apply. This Ozarks training drew veterans from 17 states. Retired Air Force Security Squadron Staff Sergeant Rachel Scott bought a 3-acre farm in Fairview, North Carolina, where she grows livestock and is launching a vegetable and brew fermentation business.
So we're building our own produce to do fermentation. So your kraut, your kimchi's, kombucha, different fermented hot sauces, soy sauces and stuff like that.
Robert Foste served in both the Marines and Army over a 24-year span from Korea to Iraq. He traveled here from northern Wisconsin.
It's a chance to meet with other folks who, like me, have all the same fears, concerns, apprehensions. And these people are kind of like, you know, a mentorship program to steer us through all the possible quicksands and glories and everything else that go with it. Yeah.
Foste says he looks forward to working on the land.
A small, sustainable farm in which I have bees, maybe some row crops and an orchard. That's what I'm looking at. Maybe some small animals, yeah. Yeah, take care of people, you know, that's what I like to do. You know, for years I've been out doing other things. You know, it's like they say, you know, my hands are dirty, but my soul's clean. That's kind of what I'm looking for.
Armed to Farm Director Margot Hale says 85% of program graduates have established agricultural careers.
They've grown their farms, they're selling at farmers markets, they're selling at restaurants, they're expanding their operation.
Some graduates are now training other veterans, which is what Kennedy Page, retired Army Human Resources, plans to do in Waller, Texas.
It was a vision that I had, so I'm learning about farming. Actually, don't know much about it. I grew up with cattle, but I'm doing vegetable farming, more of a holistic healing type of farm.
Many of these veterans are in their late 20s and early 30s, a ripe age to start a farming career, given a majority of American farmers are turning 60. Margot Hale says Armed to Farm trained veterans will help stave off a looming shortage of farmers.
Veterans are a really good population to be our next generation of farmers.
Because veterans trained in the trenches understand what it takes. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
It is Monday, June 19th, 2017. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me on the phone from his office in Fort Smith is Michael Tilley with Talk Business and Politics. Michael, when we talked Friday, we had a list of what we thought we were going to talk about, and then that just got shifted like crazy because of breaking news. We did want to talk at that time, back on Friday, about the U.S. Marshals Museum design changes that are shaving some money off construction costs. So let's talk about that today. What do you say?
Yes. Yeah. And some money. that's an interesting way to put $17 million, but they have reduced, and this is just the construction cost, but reduced it by a little bit more than 50%. It was around $36.5 million. They've cut that down to $17 million. What they made are some design and construction modifications, what they call it. They're not reducing the footprint of the 50,000 square foot what's to be a national museum. And I do want to make that point. This is a national museum for the Marshal Service. It's not just a Fort Smith or regional museum. So, we'll see. They say the exhibits aren't changing. They're not. One of the things, for example, they're doing, they don't have to do as much dirt work. They're reducing the length and the height of some of the spires for the roof. I have heard from some folks who are concerned that, you know, $17 million, that's a hefty cut, that they hope it doesn't just become kind of a glorified warehouse looking thing, a metal structure. But I don't think it will be. I know a lot of members of that board, folks that are pushing this, they wouldn't. I'd be very surprised if they allowed it to come out of the ground and look cheap.
When this museum is open, and the scheduled date is still September 2019, will be the sense that the vast majority of us who've never really seen detailed plans won't know what we're not seeing.
Well, yeah, that's true. If you don't know what was planned, you're not going to miss it. So, to that point, let's hope, you know, that impression, that first impression we get is good. And look, this has been in the works. This was announced in 2007, in early 2007. And, you know, at that time, folks were thinking it would be up and the money would be raised. And the overall budget is still around $55 million or $58 million. You know, that includes money for operating costs. They say they have about $34 million in cash and pledges and in-kind donations. So they got about $25 million to raise. You know, at the time, everyone kind of thought it'd be 3 to 5 years to get the money raised and get it built. And so we're a lot of people, including myself, are looking forward to this 2019 date to see it finally become open. I'm optimistic that it will be a good tourism draw for the region. I don't share some of the numbers that some of the museum supporters push. I think they've got some high end on those numbers, but I do think it will be a positive draw for not only the Fort Smith area, but for the state of Arkansas.
Well, given that it's been 10 years almost since the awarding, and it's been nearly 10 years since that sort of groundbreaking event in Fort Smith, there were some, I don't know if you'd say doubts, but there was some lingering skepticism. Will this 2019 opening date happen? And surely cutting 51 or 52% of construction costs alleviates some of that skepticism. Like, well, it's much more likely to happen than it wasn't.
Yeah, it does. And to be fair, let me back up a little bit. You know, this thing was announced in 2007. Well, what happened about 12 months after that?
Not even 12,
You know, that took 3 or 4 years, maybe 5 years for you know, folks who donate money and corporations and those kind of things to get some confidence back. So I'm not being critical of the museum folks. It's just been a struggle to raise that kind of money.
All right. Well, we'll talk again Friday. Michael Tilley is with Talk Business and Politics. You can read about this and many other stories 24/7 at talkbusiness.net. Michael, as always, thank you for your time.
You are welcome, sir.
Ahead on Ozarks, the Fayetteville Square is a safe place. But that hasn't always been the case.
I've got a killing on three sides of the square. I always start with the one over on the northeast side.
The authors of the new book, The Square Book, an illustrated history of the Fayetteville Square, 1828 to 2016, talk to us about the hotels, the barber shops, and more that have been in the center of the city for nearly two centuries. That's ahead on today's Ozarks at Large.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Roxane Gay, author of Bad Feminist. She talks about her new memoir, Hunger, about her life being hundreds of pounds overweight. Gay says she started gaining weight after being gang raped when she was 12. She writes that she thought if she made herself repulsive, she could keep men away. Join us.
Fresh Air, twice every weekday at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m., on 91.3 KUAF. After a weekend with rain, the forecast for the week seems to be free of showers and thunderstorms, at least for the next few days. The National Weather Service predicts clear conditions tonight, with lows from 60 to 68 across the region. Sunny with highs from 89 to 93 tomorrow. As of now, the next time rain is mentioned is Friday night, and organizers of this week's LPGA and rodeo events may not want to hear about it, but the extended forecast includes a 50% chance of thunderstorms on Saturday. Extended forecasts, of course, can always change. Support for 91.3 comes from Flora, a full-service floral studio offering delivery of unusual plants, including orchids, seasonal blooming varieties, succulent gardens, and more. Flora is located at 7 East Mountain in Fayetteville and on the web at floranwa.com. Theater Squared presents the Arkansas New Play Festival June 16th through the 25th, with events and performances taking place throughout Northwest Arkansas. The New Play Festival includes two weekends of performances, free events, and local craft beer. Seating is limited. Tickets and more information available at 443-5600. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. President Trump's move to restrict relations with Cuba is at odds with some of the interests of Arkansas's agricultural sector, And some congressional members are calling it the wrong direction. In a speech in Miami on Friday, the president announced he would reinstitute travel bans and restrict investments tied to the Cuban military and intelligence services. The Arkansas Farm Bureau's National Policy Director, Zach Bradley, says he's still optimistic agricultural trade will open up in the future.
I feel confident that the president has heard from the agriculture industry, does understand the nuances and some of the complications around the embargo and the difficulties of moving commodities from the United States.
The president says he'll only lift sanctions if Cuba frees political prisoners and holds democratic elections. U.S. Representative Rick Crawford says the embargo has been a failed and outdated posture that is a missed opportunity for rural farmers and national security. Senator John Bozeman says a return to embargo-like policies will not get the desired result, as he says has been proven over the past 50 years. Senator Tom Cotton is an exception in Arkansas. He generally supports tougher stances toward the Caribbean nation. Members of Arkansas's congressional delegation were in Fayetteville today with the United States Secretary of Veterans Affairs. David Shulkin was at the VA Medical Center in Fayetteville this morning and was joined there by Arkansas Senator John Bozeman and Congressman Steve Womack. We'll have a full report about that visit on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large. And Arkansas's unemployment rate is at another all-time low. The U.S. Department of Labor's May report lists the state's unemployment rate at 3.4%, a tenth of a percentage point below the previous month. The state's labor force for the May report increased by a net of more than 7,500 new workers.
Today, we're going to talk about trust. Why do you trust who you trust? Because when you think about it, you kind of need to trust your dentist before you get that cavity filled. You know the one. Or your mechanic before he replaces your transmission. Or your doctor before he performs open heart surgery. That trust had better be there before you show up. So, would you listen to public radio if you didn't trust us? Would you turn to us if you thought we were just sitting around making this stuff up? We bet you wouldn't. Now, more than ever, is the time to turn that trust into action. Support this station, and if you've never given before, now is the time. Trust us. You'll be glad you did.
You can learn more about your public radio station, KUAF, at KUAF.com, and you can learn more about contributing to your public radio station at support.kuaf.com. Think of every iconic building, festival, or spot in Fayetteville. Almost all of them, parks, restaurants, streets, the campus, are predated by the Fayetteville Square. In fact, the square likely predates the name Fayetteville. The first businesses opened when the city was registered as Washington Courthouse in the Arkansas Territory. Since then, thousands of businesses and interests have set up shop on the square. In the brand new The Square Book, an illustrated history of the Fayetteville Square, 1828 to 2016, Tony Wapple and J.B. Hogan give us the history, an extensive history, of who and what has been on the square since that very beginning. Nearly 400 images take us through the Civil War era, Reconstruction, a violent tornado, the Trail of Tears, the Butterfield Trail, and everything else that has touched the square. Tony Wapple's done this before. He dug into similar comprehensive histories of Dixon Street and Once Upon Dixon and College Avenue with On the Avenue. Tony and J.B. Hogan will sign copies of the book Saturday afternoon from 1 to 3 at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street, and they both discussed their work about the Square Book in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio last week. J.B. Hogan says he wanted to make sure the book began before what other history books have considered the beginning.
In the old histories, they tended to start with what I like to refer to as the Anglo-Europeans. And I think in recent years, everybody's realized there were folks here before, thank you. We might want to acknowledge them. And so we start that way now all the time. And then we start talking about the Anglo-European arrivals and then what they did.
So if Jerry, you're handling the chronological, you're handling, Tony, the geographical, meaning mm-hmm. Through this book, we find out what was in the spaces on the square all through history.
From 28 to current.
1828 to 2016, yeah. And Tony did that. Tony dug all that stuff out. It's unbelievable.
Most of it. Jerry yeah. did a lot of
I did a lot of stuff, but, I mean, that's Tony's bailiwick yeah, right
that's,
there.
It's a habit I have.
So I remember when you and I were talking about the Dixon Street book and the history of that and each, you know, inhabitor of each address, mm-hmm. we talked a little bit, how do you roll up your sleeves and find out who was there in 1830? How do you do that? What's left?
Well, actually, you start with the beginning and go backward. And then...
You mean you start with now, contemporary
times? Now, 2016,
right.
And go backwards.
Yeah.
And you look at city directories, look at census records, look at tax records, deeds, newspaper clippings, and then you start piecing it together.
So you get the square in the beginning. It's kind of shanties just thrown up there, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the town kind of builds in the 40s, and we're talking 1800s now, builds in the 1840s and 1850s, and then we're just leveled by the Civil War. I mean, we were literally burned to the ground mm-hmm. in the Civil War. So then we have the post-Civil War. We reconstruct the town. We rebuild the town. And so then you have these little phases, like 70s and 80s, you have like a little buildup. And then you make it into the turn of the century. And right after, we have these booms and stuff. And like right after the turn of the century, like 1904, there's a whole bunch of buildings built, like the Washington Hotel, the Admin Building, you know, the Wolf Building, that sort of thing. And then you have the same sort of thing all through time until you finally get into the 60s when we had the urban renewal where they tore most of the old original things down.
There were liquor stores at one point, but then they got voted out of existence?
Yeah.
The sale of alcohol for non-medicinal purposes.
say that like that could be a loophole.
Yes, it was. That's why the drugstores were so popular.
And you might remember in the very beginning, like in the 1840s and 50s, a grocery was actually a liquor store, mm-hmm. sort of a saloon.
And a dram shop.
Yeah, a dram shop. Yeah.
A dram shop.
Yeah.
And that was code for?
Code for. We got the whiskey boys.
For medicinal purposes, of course.
At that time, it was okay. That was in the, I'm not sure the years, but Temperance League sort of thing. The anti-whiskey group
70s,
and stuff.
80s,
yeah, that's right. So I guess 1870s and 80s. Yeah. Prior to the real prohibition, which also shut it down, of course.
You've got wonderful pictures throughout this book, and I want to ask you about some of them. The one that just strikes me is early in the book. It's from 1955, and here is J. William Fulbright crossing the square. It looks like he's in front of a department store.
He is. That's the Darling Shop.
And Darling.
It was a ladies' clothing store, mm-hmm. and it's where Continuing Ed is now, the University of Arkansas Continuing Ed. And it just so happens that that's also one of my very favorite photographs, and it's my absolute favorite photograph of J.W. Fulbright because he just looks like a regular guy. It's been suggested that it was like done that way. I don't care. He looks like a regular guy. I love the photograph. And this is exactly, I'm like 10 years old when that picture, and I'm here in this town. So it's like kind of meaningful to me, too.
He's got, you know, sort of some work khakis on uh-huh. and a checkered short sleeve shirt, and he looks like J. William Fulbright.
He looks just like J.W. Fulbright.
Yeah. The building that is now the Bank of Fayetteville, right? It's an iconic building.
Right.
It actually used to make an appearance on network television.
Oh, that's right.
Every Monday night, right?
Evening Shade.
Yeah.
It's right. Mary Lou Henner and Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
That was the old Lewis Brothers Hardware store.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the history of that because it's right there on the corner and it has the iconic sort of turret architecture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's beautiful. I've forgotten the exact date on it right now. Can you remember?
08, I believe. 1908?
1908, somewhere in that range.
When it was completed, no, it may have been started.
Yeah. Again, that's that little burst I talked about in the 1900s. 1900s were a really important period here. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of really famous people were born that time. J.W., he was 1 year old when he got here. Mm-hmm. Edward Durrell Stone, Charles Morrow Wilson. I call it the generation of distinction. Mm-hmm. And my gosh, really famous people from Fayetteville, and it was tiny at the time.
Back to the Bank of Fayetteville, that was originally W.T. Farrar, hardware company.
That's right.
And when he passed away, the Lewis brothers, the five Lewis brothers, bought out the hardware store and ran it until the 70s.
And, of course, John Lewis then becomes a champion of the square, of Fayetteville in general. But
Mr. Fayetteville.
In the 70s and 80s, when the square is beginning to wane, the department stores are beginning to leave, the mall has opened up.
Right.
He kind of becomes the champion to, let's build this thing back up.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I read one time he said that the urban renewal was kind of a mistake. And so, and he cared so much, I think he tried to reverse that to some degree.
Right.
For me, the worst part of the urban renewal was that they took out the east side of the square entirely, and the east side was always my favorite side. And throughout history, when I go back and look, it's still my favorite. And I think it was my favorite because the Palace Theater was over there, which was, it was a great theater to go to.
What else was on the east side, if it was your favorite side?
Well, when I was a kid in the 50s, the Hunt's was on the north end.
The Hunt's.
Hunt's department store.
Okay.
And that's where you went to get your PE stuff for junior high and high school. And then what was next?
Fayetteville Drug was
yeah,
there.
Okay, Fayetteville Drug was next.
Kleinhans.
Kleinhans, Fayetteville Drug. And then I'm just going to do the Palace. And then I've forgotten the next store.
Walton's was there for a while.
That's right, a little bit later.
Right.
Yeah,
like
it was
the Five
Ben
and Dime?
Frame.
Yeah,
well,
yeah,
yeah
that
Dime.
Was his
right.
second store in yeah. town was there. That was just a little bit later than the time frame I'm in.
The ads that you include,
yeah.
newspaper ads, phone book ads. I mean,
yeah,
it's one thing.
Mostly from the phone book, yeah.
Yeah, it's one thing to read about these places and even to see the shell of the building, but you kind of get more of a personality of what was the soul of these places.
I absolutely personally love the ads in this book. I love them. I found a lot of them myself in researching, looking at the old microfilm of the newspaper, and I just absolutely love them. They're so entertaining. What's the one I like so much? Is it the Campbell Bell? It looks like a little flying razorback.
The running razorback.
Yeah,
yes.
Maybe he's running, but he looks almost like he's flying. Just love that kind of thing.
In the 1940s.
Yeah, 1940s. Right?
Campbell Bell was on the square for a long time.
1901.
Yeah, there you go. 1901 till what?
90s, early 90s?
1994,
yeah.
That's a fair run.
What surprised you while putting this together? Were there any things that you thought to yourself, well, I had no idea or I would never believe that? You're both nodding your heads.
One thing that surprised me was the section on Block Street, North Block, where JR's used to be, and it was all bricked.
Oh, yeah.
The facade was solid brick, and it reminded me of the brick facade in Campbell Bell, which was done in the 1950s. Well, the section on Block Street was done in the 30s, so it predated the Campbell Bell brick facade, and I'm not sure why they did that. I guess they were being modern 20 years earlier.
So. They had their time.
Yeah.
For me, one of the big surprises was we found at least three African-American businesses. Mm-hmm. And this is a good chance to plug one of our friends who is a great researcher, Gary Coover. Mm-hmm. And Gary found, I believe the man's name is Nathan Dixon, 1870s, Tony. He had a restaurant called the Buckhorn Restaurant on the south side of the square. He went out of business because he said his friends and family ate him out of house and home. But that was a Gary Coover find. It's a wonderful find. There were a couple others as well. That was a surprise to me.
Mose Edwards, he was a barber.
That's right.
And there's a Mrs. Williams. I could never find her first name. She had a restaurant in the building that predated the Eason building.
Well, that brings me to my next question. Other than Mrs. Williams' first name, what else were you just unable to come across despite the exhaustive efforts? Did anything get away from you?
I would have liked to find a photo of the Burnside Hotel.
Burnside Hotel.
Yeah, that would be great. That's where the Visitors Bureau is now, basically. That's where the Butterfield stage would pull in after they originally pulled in over by the Ozark Theater, and then in just a few months they shifted over there. Yeah, that would be a fantastic.
Of course, it burned during the Civil War. So.
Right. Yeah.
But not even a sketch. We didn't even find a sketch. So.
There were parades, events. I'm sure Saturdays at the height of the commercial era when you had Piggly Wiggly and Montgomery Ward and things like that, it was busy. Mm-hmm. Any, you go to Coffeyville, Kansas and the Dalton brothers, you can trace their steps around. Any nefarious or sort of dangerous things happen on the Fayetteville Square?
Yes, they did. That's one of my little things. Is I've got a killing on three sides of the square. I always start with the one over on the northeast side. And I'm going to get my dates wrong probably because I'm doing it off the top of my head. I believe it's
18. But they're
18,
in the book.
18, in the book. Yeah, you'll
be
in there.
Some of them are.
Some of them are.
Yeah, not all.
But
not all.
If they're not there, they'll be in my book in about 15 months.
Okay.
I believe it's 1881 when City Marshal Will Patton and a deputy whose name escapes me right now were shot dead right in the intersection at East and East Center. I mean, right there, like if you walk out into the walkway, you're basically standing where those men were shot dead on a Saturday night. It was a result of a big, long feud with a gang out of West Fork, the Reed family. And so that's the one over there. I'll shift to the west side. Then earlier, 1839 on the west side, basically in the doorway where Campbell Bell was, was the Wallace Family Grocery. And during the Trail of Tears, the Cherokee came here and they camped. And they came back up to town and the Wallace family opened their grocery. And so they started selling whiskey and a fight ensued. And one of the boys named Willis Wallace killed one of the Cherokee named Nelson Orr, stabbed him to death with essentially a Bowie knife, a knife that big. Willis Wallace was a really dangerous man. Later on, and he was defending his younger brother, Riley. Later on the east side, some guys came to town. It's a giant hypocrisy here on a Sunday. And they were playing cards. The Cherokee were here on a Sunday also, and the Wallace opened up to sell him whiskey. But these guys weren't allowed to play cards, apparently, by the Wallace brothers. I don't understand that. They went over there. And Willis killed one of those guys and stabbed another and drove his knife through his body into the ground. He was saved by Dr. T.J. Pollard. He lived, and then the younger brother, Riley, shot and killed him about 2 or 3 months later. They were vicious guys. They ended up getting acquitted all the time, and they eventually left town. They were violent people.
What was the name here?
Willis Wallace is the older brother, and Riley Wallace is his younger brother. And the dad, I believe his name was William, like the... You know, the Scottish guy, I think mm-hmm. William Wallace was the dad. And they owned a grocery, again. A dram shop on the west side of the square. Basically, like I said, looking where at Campbell the old, Bell. Right about the door where Campbell Bell goes in. So that was really wild and violent stuff. And then on the south side had a really strange one, an argument, I believe, between an owner of a drugstore, I believe it was, and an investor. And he killed the man, I've forgotten his first name, his last name was Ben Brook. And he's buried over in Evergreen Cemetery. Mm-hmm. And he was shot and killed over an argument, I assume, about their financial status of the business and stuff.
There's a building in the middle of the square that we have a three-word name for it. When it was built, it wouldn't have been called the old post office.
No.
It was called the post office.
Yeah, the post office. 1911 they opened. Right. It was opened from 1911 to 1963. I actually have memories of being in there. I remember being in the post office when it was functional.
Mm-hmm. So that whole thing was a post office? It's huge. It's a lot of square footage.
Gigantic. Mm-hmm.
What was downstairs before it was the dance club?
I assume that's where they were doing their mail sorting. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because everything was office boxes back then, too.
Yeah, because everything was up on that first level. Right. You came in on the north side, as I recall, and went in, and to the left is where the clerks and the things were.
You know, and you had the area where they delivered the mail, or picked up the mail for delivery, or delivered it back, I guess, from customers.
Closed in 63.
Mm-hmm.
Moved to Dixon.
Yeah, opened Dixon Street. J.W. Fulbright gave the speech that day.
He's all over the place.
He is everywhere.
and when did we start calling it the old post office? Obviously, it was probably after it closed.
It seemed like around the 90s it started taking on that.
I mean, it kind of got that name.
No, it was the old post office in at least the 80s.
Oh, really?
Probably
okay.
The 70s when it was almost torn down. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right.
And there was a major protest in town to save it. And it was saved, put on the National Register.
Thank goodness.
And I believe one of the first businesses was the OPO.
The OPO, right.
Yes, yeah. The old post office. Yeah. And they were up and running, very active in the 80s when I came to Fayetteville.
When you're putting this together, and there are oftentimes you'll say this building, in parentheses, where the such and such is now.
Right.
Do you ever feel weird about that? Because one thing you've probably learned is that nothing stays there forever. And at some point, someone will pick up this building and it will say, where the such and such is now. And they'll say, What's that? Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Deal with that with W.S. Campbell all the time.
Yeah, I was going to say, W.S. Campbell did that throughout his entire book. And
The 100 Years of Fayetteville.
Yeah, it's very difficult to track.
But in this book, see, if you follow with Tony, he gives you the addresses all the time.
Of course, the addresses change, too. One thing I like, this is just sort of fun, and Jerry may have more insight on it. There were a lot of businesses that honored the heavens. Like, there were two liveries. One was called the Star Livery, which the Taylor family owned. And across the street was Joseph Vaughn's Eclipse Livery. So he was eclipsing the Star Livery. We had the Comet Saloon. We had the Morning Star Saloon. So I'm not sure what the attraction was to.
I have tried to pin that down to Halley's Comet. Remember, Halley's Comet came in the year that Mark Twain was born. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what year that was. So the year that Twain was born and the year he died both match up to Halley's Comet. I feel like there was some kind of, surge in the astronomical knowledge or something during that period of time. It's maybe accounts for that. I'm just guessing. But I suspect it was. Can you imagine in the skies in the whenever Halley's Comet came in that early part of the 1800s, how clearly it would have been visible?
Sure, light pollution was not a problem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It would have been maybe even terrifying to some people to see it.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tony Wapple and J.B. Hogan will sign copies of The Square Book, an illustrated history of the Fayetteville Square, 1828 to 2016, Saturday afternoon from 1 until 3 at Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. You know, Nightbird Books. They used to be the Ozark Mountain Smokehouse. And before that was, well, Tony's previous book, Once Upon Dixon, can give you all that information. This is Ozarks at Large. And from the past to the passive voice. Tomorrow on Ozarks, our militant grammarian takes on the passive voice.
The thing about the passive voice is it allows you to say something that was done or said or believed without saying who did it or said it.
Catherine Churlds, our militant grammarian, with another Tuesday visit on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF.
A warehouse job that once took hours now takes minutes and involves fewer humans.
So these are the Amazon robots. They're orange, square shapes.
Humans and robots working side by side. I'm Ari Shapiro. We go inside an Amazon distribution center to look at the work of pickers. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 3 to 6 on 91.3. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals will be back in the Texas League playoffs later this year. We know that because the Naturals clinched the first half Texas League North Division title Saturday night with a 4-1 win over Tulsa. It will be the third consecutive year the Naturals have been in the postseason. By the way, yesterday's scheduled game against the Arkansas Travelers rained out. The Nats and Travs are scheduled to play a doubleheader tonight in North Little Rock. The Naturals are next home in Springdale Thursday night. The Arkansas Razorback baseball team will have a new assistant coach when the 2018 season begins next February. Nate Thompson replaces the departing Tony Vitello. Thompson was in Fayetteville recently. He's leaving his job as a coach on the staff of Missouri State, the team that defeated Arkansas this month in the NCAA regionals. Tony Vitello left Arkansas to become head coach at Tennessee. And that NCAA regional in Fayetteville earlier this month, by the way, it was announced last week that it had the highest attendance of any of the 16 first-round regionals that took place across the country. Nearly 68,000 fans watched the games at Baum Stadium, about 5,000 more than attended the regional in Baton Rouge, hosted by LSU. Qualifying is taking place in Rogers today for the LPGA's Northwest Arkansas Championship stop on the Women's Professional Golf Tour. Players not already qualified to participate in this weekend's tourney can become part of the official field by finishing at the top of today's qualifying round. Golfers seeking the last spots today include a pair of current Arkansas Razorbacks, Maria Fossey and Kaylee Benton. And a junior golf event postponed because of inclement weather will now take place in Lowell Sunday. The drive, chip, and putt qualifier is now set for Sunday from 8 a.m. until noon at the First Tee Learning Center at 715 East Monroe in Lowell. The third annual local version of this event is open to girls and boys ages 7 to 15. More information can be found at thefirsttee.northwestarkansas.org. It's Monday, June 19th, 2017. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me, the survivor of another weekend, is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
My calendar is very confused right now.
Because?
Because, first of all, we're doing the free weekly now.
Right.
My folks and I. And that happens on Tuesday.
It happens on Tuesday, so it can be out on Thursday.
Exactly. And so that confuses me because I think that Tuesday is Wednesday because that's when we put together What's Up.
You put it together on Wednesday so it can be in the paper on Friday.
So I'm confused to start with.
I get that. I understand why.
And then it's Rodeo of the Ozarks time. And it's not time for the Rodeo of the Ozarks.
For decades, it was every July 1, 2, 3, 4 in
yes.
Springdale. That was just
always
part of the Northwest Arkansas calendar.
Yes.
Now, is this the second year they've moved it or the first?
Second.
Second year.
And the reasoning is that cowboys ride to make money.
I mean, it's their job.
So the 4th of July weekend, or the days around the 4th of July, there's a ton of rodeos out west that you can do several together.
And make more money.
And make more money.
And some of them have very big purses.
And so you're not going to come to Rodeo of the Ozarks if it's competing against the six others you could do in 8 days
right.
out west. So they moved it to a date where they're catching cowboys who are coming from bigger rodeos through this area.
So better talent.
Sort of like we catch bands as they're going
to South
back
by Southwest.
And forth. And so rodeo is now this Wednesday through Saturday. We're very confused.
But they still have the parades and all of that.
Exactly. And the cool thing this year, who knew there was a Marine Corps mounted color guard?
I didn't until just now.
I didn't either until I was looking for something cool to tell people about. And it started in 1967 at the Marine Corps Logistics Base in Barstow, California. The commander had just come back. He was a lieutenant colonel. He had just come back from Vietnam, and he saw that the kids that were housed on the base were riding horses that were stabled there. And he thought, well, why don't we have a mounted color guard? So they do. And right now there are 7 members, and they start their year riding in the Tournament of Roses parade on January 1st, mm-hmm. and then do rodeos and parades across the country. Their big months are April through October. This is the first time they've been in Arkansas. Great quote from Rick Culver, who's the executive director of the rodeo. It's not quite like jets flying over, but it's pretty sharp.
I get it, yeah.
All right, so 7:30, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday for the rodeo at Parsons Stadium in Springdale. Tickets start cheap at like $7. And then the rodeo parades are 3 o'clock Wednesday, and here's a change this year, 3 o'clock on Saturday. It used to be 10 a.m. on Saturday.
Oh, okay.
For years.
Well, it wasn't hot enough at 10.
That's it. No, they're just trying to make it easier for people to come into town and stay.
Sure.
So,
oh, I see. So if you're coming to the parade and then you want to go to the rodeo
yeah.
too.
Yeah. Just hang out. And also this week, another thing in Springdale, Shiloh sandwiched in on Wednesday, which is one of the coolest events you can go to. It's almost as cool as Mountain Street Stage.
Mm-hmm.
This week, it's Brandon Weston, who works at the university. But he grew up in the Ozarks, like out of town, you know, with hoop snake stories and home remedies. And so he's going to speak about Ozark folk healing.
All right.
This happens at noon on Wednesday at the Shiloh Museum. It is free, and there are cookies.
So on Wednesday, you could go to this.
You could.
Hang out when it's done. Catch a parade. Hang out when that's done.
Go
then
to
watch
the
people ride wild animals and maybe break their shoulders.
Exactly.
After that. Yeah, okay.
And also this week, there's a family concert today at 6:30 at the Fayetteville Public Library with songwriter Will Parker, part of the summer reading program.
Yeah.
On Tuesday, Evenings on the Lawn from 4 to 6 at Rogers Historical Museum. That's free all summer, and this week is learning about fishing.
All right.
Tyson Foods Tuesday nights with free admission from 5 to 8 at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks in Fayetteville. And then we come back around for the new play festival on Thursday with Transatlantic at 7:30 at Theater Squared in Fayetteville. And on Friday, there's a Transatlantic workshop production at 7:30 where they'll be making changes sort of as they go. And that'll be cool.
And Friday afternoon at 4, Theater Squared's doing something. They're breaking ground for that new theater facility.
And Friday evening is family movie night at 8:30 at Crystal Bridges. If you can't find something to do here in the summer.
Almost everything you've mentioned today is free as well.
I know, isn't that cool?
That is very cool.
So go have fun.
All right. And don't spend much cash.
Exactly.
Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs. Joseph Lee Baker Jr. was born in 1944. He likely could have been a highly paid studio session player, but the guitarist chose to be a disciple of the blues instead. His high school band was called the Blazers, which stayed together after high school when its members all attended Memphis State. Baker's first studio experience was in Memphis with the Blazers and Arkansas-er Roland Jaynes of Clay County at the board. Baker toured with the Marquees, played with the likes of Arkansas-er Charlie Rich, and such luminaries of the blues as Booker White, Gus Cannon, Sleepy John Estes, Mississippi Fred McDowell, and Rufus Thomas. Baker particularly connected with bluesman Furry Lewis. "Furry taught me how to lay back a whole lot," Baker later said. Baker became especially adept at slide guitar. In the late 1960s, Lee Baker formed Moloch, a psychedelic blues quintet that played shows with the MC5 and the Stooges. A scandalous show in Fayetteville, Arkansas nearly got the band, its dancers, and promoter Randall Lyon of Little Rock arrested. Moloch's 1970 debut was on the Stax subsidiary, Enterprise Records, named after the starship on Brinkley native Al Bell's favorite TV show, Star Trek. Busta Jones of Memphis joined Moloch on bass after the album's completion and went on to play with Talking Heads, Stevie Wonder, and others. Eponymous Moloch album includes the first version of Going Down, later covered by Deep Purple, Joe Walsh, Brian Ferry, The Who, and Pearl Jam, among many others. Freddie King's version heard here was the theme to the TV comedy Eastbound and Down. "We formed Moloch before heavy metal," Baker explained. "We wanted to be loud, rockin', and offensive. I got lumps in my throat when I saw her walking down the aisle. I got the weakness in my knees when she looked at me and saw her smile. After releasing a subsequent Moloch single on his own Booger Records, Lee Baker left the band in spring 1972. His quartet, Mud Boy and the Neutrons, debuted that Halloween in Memphis, featuring Baker, Sid Selvage, Jimmy Crosswaite, and Little Rock native Jim Dickinson. "All we are is a backing band for Baker," Dickinson said of Mud Boy. The band issued Known Felons and Drag in 1986 and Negro Streets at Dawn in 1993. Rebecca's coat said the night is short. He reached in his pocket and he flashed a quart. Hollered, "Rainbow, chillin' out with ya. Rainbow, Cassie cried. It's almost dawn and the cops are gone. Let's all get Dixie fried." Lee Baker additionally played on many other classic, if obscure, 1970s Memphis albums, including Big Star's Third, Alex Chilton's Like Flies on Sherbert, and Jim Dickinson's 1972 debut solo album, Dixie Fried. The bravest man we ever saw, and he showed us all he wasn't afraid of the law. Through the black cross bars, he taught a note to his dear. He said, "It ain't my fault, I'm still in here. You can rain on Cassie cry. It's almost dawn, and the cops ain't gone, and I've been Texas fried." Thank you. Also in the 1980s, Baker formed Lee Baker and the Agitators, a more straight blues rock quartet than Mudboy and the Neutrons would ever aspire to be. Some Agitator band members had been in Moloch, most notably fellow guitarist Jimmy Sigerson. He wrote much of the material the Agitators recorded for the 1996 album debut. The 1990s had brought renewed interest in the blues, as well as nostalgia for Baker's legendary other bands. Baker, too, was known for his nurturing of the Memphis music scene, especially its old-style blues players like Furry Lewis. But in a tragic twist, Lee Baker and his 75-year-old Aunt Sally McKay were murdered September 10, 1996, in Horseshoe Lake in Crittenden County. It was later revealed to be a botched robbery attempt by two teenagers who had previously robbed and burned down Baker's home near Hughes in St. Francis County 3 weeks before. A few months later, the Agitators' only full album, Fresh Oil, was released. "I always wanted to be more than just somebody that could play three chords," Baker said of his guitar work. That Lee Baker was. Here it is, guitarist and vocalist Lee Baker, who lived and died in East Arkansas with Mona from Baker's band Moloch. Session guitarist and vocalist Lee Baker, a member of Moloch, Mudboy and the Neutrons, and the Agitators, who lived and died in East Arkansas with the Moloch song Mona from 1969. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Executive producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs is underwritten by the Old Statehouse Museum in Little Rock, a museum of the Department of Arkansas Heritage. Arkansongs, since 1998.
91.3 is supported in part by David Adams Fine Jewelry, offering design, creation, and repair of all jewelry in silver, gold, and platinum. All work is performed in-house. Diamond and colored stone designs are on display at the downtown Fayetteville Square Gallery and online at davidadams.com. 91.3 FM KUAF is supported by Highlands Oncology Group. Highlands Oncology's cancer specialists provide comprehensive, collaborative care, allowing patients and families to stay close to home. With locations in Benton and Washington counties, Highlands Oncology is helping patients fight the battle every day. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com. Opera in the Ozarks presents its 67th season June 23rd through July 21st at Inspiration Point in Eureka Springs. The season features 22 performances of three fully staged operas: Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, Bizet's Carmen, and Carlisle Floyd's Susanna. Sunday performances will be held at Arend Arts Center in Bentonville. Tickets and schedule at opera.org. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Red Star. Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks for listening. We'll end today's program with some sounds of hard volunteer work. A local sustainable trail advocacy group spent several days over the last couple of months at Mount Kessler Regional Park volunteering to improve the trail system as part of a master plan adopted by the city of Fayetteville. We stopped by one of the Ozark off-road cyclist work days this past weekend. Volunteers spent part of their Saturday morning working to reroute unsustainable portions of a trail called Crazy Mary, and this is what it sounded like Saturday morning.
You usually get into a fair amount of just roots.
Yeah.
That first section, I usually just peel that first section off and get that gone and out of the way.